This episode is brought to you by the Arvada Center, because they're kicking off their summer concert series in June. Relax under the stars at the Arvada Center's outdoor amphitheater and take in acts like Melissa Etheridge, Big Richard, Tower of Power, Preservation Hall Jazz Band, The Spin Doctors, and so much more. Concerts are scheduled for June through September. You can find a whole schedule of events and get your tickets today at arvadacenter.org. That's arvadacenter.org. Today on CityCast Denver, a music promoter is in jail, an immersive art empire is expanding, and the promise of a new music district in Rhino may be dying. So I'm sitting down with one of our favorite art scene reporters to dig into the big news stories coming out of Denver's creative economy. Also, just a note, this episode mentions sexual assault, so please take care when listening. Today is Wednesday, May 8th. I'm Bree Davies, and here's what Denver's talking about. John Wenzel, welcome back to CityCast Denver.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
So we wanted to have you back because there's a lot of interesting stuff happening sort of in and around the art world in Denver right now. And I want to start with the recent arrest of Jay Bianchi. For folks maybe new to this story, who is Jay Bianchi?
So he is a, now former promoter, bar owner, and just kind of jam band scene mixture, or fixture rather. He used to own Sancho's Broken Arrow, which is shut down. These are all Grateful Dead themed bars, usually with stages, live music. He co-owned So Many Roads, which is a brewery, also just shut down. He divested of those, but he used to also own some other places, Quixote's, Beyond Key, Psychedelic Ripple, that burned to the ground.
I know. I was like, wow, thinking yeah. about all these venues. I may have accidentally played one at one point as well.
Yeah. I mean, it's he's been a fixture in the scene for a long time. And I'm not even getting it, you know, probably half of his bars and stuff.
So he was established. He was known yeah. again.
Businessman.
Beyond that. I mean, the jam band scene for sure. Collector of Grateful Dead, everything. But also just somebody that I think a lot of musicians interacted with. Even you didn't even have to sort of be in the jam band scene because he was running these venues for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, he was a personality too. Yeah, to a lot of people.
That's a way to put it. Well, yeah. You reported on some very serious allegations against Bianchi back in 2021. How did we get from there to this arrest 3 years later?
Well, we got a little more clarity from the affidavit, which the Denver Post only got on Friday. That's the arrest report. And the formal charges were last week, multiple charges, allegations of sexual assault against, I think, at least three women. Two were people who came forward publicly, and I reported that. And one was allegedly just last month at So Many Roads on April 7th. So according to the affidavit, and this gave us some more clarity, it was a preponderance of evidence collected that seemed to tip the scale, because he was for a long time, you know, seemingly Teflon-ish.
I was just going to say untouchable for sure, a little bit, like, because again, these are allegations surfaced 3 years ago, and it, you know, I don't want to say it's common in a scene, but sometimes these stories are, you know, get picked up and things happen. And I was kind of surprised.
Yeah.
I don't know. It just, it doesn't happen that often, I guess. And so I just wonder what, like you said, he'd already divested from these bars. He wasn't as prominent as he once was. What do you think that this arrest means for sort of the jam band scene or sort of live music in general here in Denver?
Well, it's definitely, and for the past 3 years, it's been splitting the jam band scene. And increasingly he has fewer supporters. But if you look on social media, you know, he's got supporters who will support him regardless. And that's been true over the years, because where he's not Teflon-ish is, you know, he does have various convictions, at least 9 that I found going back a few decades.
Oh, wow.
For assault, drug possession, not sexual assault, but okay. assault, you know, financial stuff. He's gotten in hot water over not paying people a lot of money. And in the affidavit, we also found out that, you know, there was a woman who declined to press charges in Boulder in 2016, who they matched, and you know, there's some sensitive language here, but they matched his semen to DNA collected from some of these other investigations. So that was, I think, the tipping point for some people. And that's why it's happening now, as opposed to 2021, despite these women who made the allegations then submitting to, you know, sexual assault evidence kits in the hospital, going through a lot of abuse, a lot of people attacking them. So, to, you know, to answer your question more directly, I think it's shaken the jam band scene very deeply. People have been calling for accountability for a long time.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's not the only instances of women saying they've been drugged and assaulted. You know, it's not just these bars. It's not just him. I've reported a lot of that, unfortunately. But I think, you know, people have been telling me they feel like he's being held accountable.
Finally. Yeah, that's interesting you say that about just the knowledge, the common, I guess, common knowledge about places that women shouldn't go, or there's plenty of venues and experiences.
Private Facebook groups been talking about this for years. And, you know, the quote unquote open secret, which is such a sad
but it's like the power structure here. We've got a promoter versus bands. Like, it can get really complicated. And it really came down to the fact that there was evidence to back up the claims of some of these individuals who had been saying this for a long time. So, I mean, I hope with anything, it's like this brings a level of transparency. And like everything, when it comes to these issues, hopefully the next generation doesn't have to deal with something like this kind of thing.
So. Yeah, I mean, it creates a precedent. It sets sort of a culture of where, you know,
totally,
we're all talking to each other. And I say that, you know, as I have a lot of privilege as a white guy, you know, a lot of this I've never experienced and certainly, you know, didn't see on the surface, but a lot of people could say that too. And the women who have experienced this kind of behavior, wherever it is, you know, they know, they've always known. So
yeah, and there's a lot of fear in coming forward sometimes, because then you get isolated and people don't want to work with you. You know, it's just so complicated. So it's like, it's not about vindication or anything, but these folks' experiences have been affirmed, and maybe this changes something for the better for the scene in general.
Yeah, that's the sense I'm getting.
Well, let's move on to Meowulf, our next topic. I mean, the immersive art and entertainment company laid off 165 people earlier this month, which included 50 folks right here at Convergence Station in Denver. But last week you reported that they were expanding to LA. They just opened a location outside of Dallas. They have one in Houston slated to open soon. You've covered labor issues for Meowulf extensively. What do you think about this expansion sort of in the context of this layoffs conversation?
I think on its face to some people, you know, it seems contradictory. Why lay people off and then immediately announce expansion? And I think what the company will tell you is that they're finally kind of, you know, quote unquote, right-sizing and finding their business model. And they overhired and, you know, they did lay off half their staff a few years ago. You know, they laid off like 200 people, I think it was, in 2020, 2021.
Because it was the midst of the pandemic, but it was before they had opened here.
Correct.
I remember because I had friends in Santa Fe that got laid off.
Yeah. And the Santa Fe reporter found some information that was always coming, even though they blamed it on the pandemic. But, you know, this new round, it's painful, you know, and that included, I think, some bargaining unit positions in Vegas. But, you know, the union was not happy about this. They do not seem to be mounting a huge
fight.
Exactly on it. But yeah, I think on its face, it seems contradictory. And kind of is.
Yeah, like, well, I mean, it's just this
cut costs up to 10% and then also announce an expansion. And I've heard, you know, they're also going to do another one after that.
I think they're a large company now, right? They're this like massive company, but they also work in the art world. And so sometimes I think there's this pressure or confusion around like the ethics or the ethos of an art scene versus a corporation, but those things are together now. And like you said, maybe right-sizing the company is what's going on, but on the surface of it, some people just see layoffs, expansion. It doesn't make sense.
Yeah. And they're one of those companies that is not unique in that they're moving from an artist collective or a nonprofit or sort of a loose non-business oriented creative concern into one. And that's messy, but theirs has been a lot more public, I think, because they talk a big game.
I was just going to say, why do you think that is? Because I agree with you. We pay a lot more attention to Meowulf's moves than some other organizations that have come out of art collectives.
Yeah. Well, they got tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars in investments. They brought over executives from Disney. You know what I mean? Like, they scaled up fast, and they came into town, big footing, throwing money around, getting people on their narrative teams. A lot of really good people who do really good art. I mean, there's some amazing, wonderful art in that building. But, you know, if you're going to do that, you deserve the scrutiny, too.
Yeah.
And they, you know, have not always done right by their employees, according to people I've talked to. I talked to a lot of people, and, you know, they describe a real internal struggle between corporate culture and, you know, progressive, artistic, creative values. So that's been going on, it seems, for a while there.
Yeah. And they kind of are maybe one of the first of this era of, you know, our generation's art becoming a corporate thing, and they're figuring it out very publicly, and
yeah.
other things will come along that learn from them, unfortunately. But
yeah, and I think there's still, you know, there's a lot of room for them to
totally.
To be an example. And I think in some ways they have, you know, they did kind of invent a new immersive art model, but at the same time, like, you know, are you a haunted house? Are you a museum? Are you, you know, the Museum of Illusions? Like, figure out, you know, and they are still figuring that out. So
yeah.
It's complicated, but I do think it's fair for these employees to feel, you know, jilted and sort of like they got the rug pulled out from under them.
Yeah. And again, it does that. I would imagine it being a little bit, I mean, full disclosure, my husband has a room inside of Meow Wolf. He's done this work. And so you're still an artist, but you're dealing with, you know, OSHA regulations and all these things that go into building a thing that the public can see. And you, I don't know, it's just so much more complicated than like an art installation that you've done at your friend's warehouse or whatever. But
absolutely.
The cool part is too, they employ people to do this.
Right. And I think, you know, some of the people they employed who were really psyched that they got employed yeah. by them, you know, like Kaylin Heffernan, who yeah. worked with your husband, you know, she's been vocal about, you know, criticizing them as well. And I think that's not talking out of both sides of your mouth. I think it's absolutely yeah. not dissonant to be like, we love getting paid for art. We also want to hold them accountable for all the things they're saying. You know, we're going to reinvigorate Sun Valley. We're going to, you know, we're starting a new thing. And it's like, okay, show us that.
The Sun Valley thing, I wanted, that remains to be seen to me. I want to see a little bit more of that as it unfolds. But, you know, right before Convergence Station opened in September of 2021, you wrote, quote, with a projected 1 million+ visitors annually, according to the company, Meow Wolf's Denver facility could also reshape the city and state's beleaguered arts economy. Mm-hmm. John, I was so with you on this optimism. What do you think about Meow Wolf now, sort of in the arts economy of 2024?
I think what we've seen since then, and certainly post-pandemic, is that, you know, public money has a huge effect in keeping everyone alive, whether it's SCFD or I think the state legislature. I know we got like $1.25 million more for, you know, Colorado Business Committee for the Arts and some other people. So I think we've seen that private investment is overhyped. And I didn't want to be part of that because I did couch my language, but, you know, there was a lot of optimism.
Absolutely.
And, you know, they were making money hand over fist. They were getting written up. So there wasn't a ton of reason to believe that it would, you know, fall out as much as it has.
Well, it popped off in Santa Fe when they first opened. They blew expectations out of the water. It was this yeah. thing that people couldn't believe existed. Those of us that have been in the arts world forever were like, whoa, yeah. this thing that we saw on a very DIY scale is doing this thing. But, you know, now they're in, I don't know, five cities or whatever.
Yeah. Houston, Dallas, suburb, you know, places like that.
Las Vegas, different ballgame.
Totally.
Just a different ballgame.
Yeah. So it's hard to say, you know, to damn them, and it's hard to praise them. But I think you can do both in certain instances. But as a company, I mean, they're evolving so rapidly. It's fascinating and sort of destabilizing.
Be interesting to see in 10 years what our,
oh, yeah.
you know, what our DIY world brought to the corporate world and then what happened mm-hmm. after that. This episode is brought to you by Pine Melon, the farmer's market delivered. Pine Melon is a next generation grocery delivery app that partners with over 200 farmers, ranchers, and producers in Colorado to help make fresh, locally sourced foods available to the Denver community at fair prices. Get high quality meats, eggs, and dairy from small local farms, fresh baked breads from local bakeries, and more, as well as all of your favorite pantry staples. Best part is, Pine Melon offers same-day delivery to Denver and soon Boulder within a two-hour window, no subscription necessary. Save time in your busy schedule and get fresh and healthy groceries delivered right to your door. Join the movement and support local today. Use promo code CITYCASTDENVER for $75 off your first delivery at pinemelon.com. That's pinemelon.com.
Well, let's move on to our last topic, which is also a follow-up to a story we had you on to talk about last year. Local music company Vinyl Me Please opened a new record pressing plant here in the Rhino neighborhood. Business End reports that Vinyl Me Please has fired three top executives, including their CEO, and they're also suing them over this exact plant. What went wrong, John?
This is another situation where I think the hype that preceded it was so deafening and yet hopeful.
Man, you and me were excited.
I know that. Well, because Vinyl Me Please's product is amazing. Yeah. You know, they have a few thousand subscribers. It's very expensive. They do really high end, you know, record repressings, and it's a monthly record club. And you know, there was no reason to think there were a lot of holes in this. And that includes a lot of media who hyped it up, and including the Denver Post and, you know, Business Den, not intentionally. I know the reporter who wrote that, Justin Wingerter, is amazing, and this was not his intention, but he kind of shamed us all, you know? It was like, you know, get your ducks in a row. Like, this is not the company you might think it is. So, you know, over years of reporting, you know, they represented this vinyl plant in Rhino across the street from Mission Ballroom and AEG's offices. It was going to be part of this new sort of music district just down the street from Victrola's world headquarters, you know, sort of a vertically integrated music system, I think I said on the last one. But yeah, it turns out the plant was actually behind the scenes going to be an independent thing, and they were going to sign a contract with them for quite a bit of money to do this. And Cameron Schaefer, their CEO, and some other folks, the other two folks they're suing, misrepresented the nature of this to the board, hid expenditures of hundreds of thousands of dollars. And it turns out this was a pet project. And these are the allegations, right?
Sure.
I don't know these things for sure. But the board did fire them in March and then sued them last week. And so what's shocking here is that this was their main thing they were touting for years.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure why the board, and I'm sure I'll be digging into this, but I'm not sure why the board was so blindsided
by this.
That's
what I thought was like, how are they not aware?
Because it was their main thing. And right. That's what I wrote about. And that's what we've all written about, you know? So, yeah, I don't know. It's drama. That is some music district drama.
It really is. I'm curious to see what happens, though, because it's not like the need for a vinyl pressing plant has gone away. I think, if anything, it's still cool that we have one in this part of the country. How it ends up operating, I think, would be, I guess, remains to be seen. But, you know, you were just kind of talking about this sort of the dreams of this, like, music district, this industry around this record pressing plant. How do you think they're going to come out of it? Or how do you think we're going to come out of it as a city or this with this big dream for this music district?
You know, it was always mostly marketing. You know, there's a lot of quote unquote music districts in this town, and you could make arguments for different ones.
Yeah. But maybe it's for the industry, right?
Oh, totally,
we want
yeah.
more industry here as music people.
Totally. Yeah, more management. You know, we've already got a lot.
Yeah, we've got venues, we've got bands, but these infrastructure pieces were so crucial.
Totally. And it's exciting to think, you know, they were going to have this listening room and they were going to have bands stop in there. And one of the things in the lawsuit, one of the details is that they spent too much money on, hundreds of thousands of dollars on a sound system that was really an amenity, not a necessary
need.
Thing. So, you know, it definitely dings those aspirations. It definitely makes them look a little more, a little bit over Mickey Mouse operation. Like, how could you not know all this? But, you know, at the same time, like, they didn't. And it remains to be seen in court, you know, what shakes out. I'm sure some more interesting details. But, yeah, they were just, you know, going full bore ahead. And they didn't, you know, they don't have much to show for it. And the lawsuit also stipulates, or not stipulates, but alleges that the plant is also under par. You know, it's not, they're not going to be up to snuff if they start printing Vinyl Me Please stuff. It's not meeting expectations. And that's tragic. Why build a vinyl plant and not have it be just excellent? There's so much demand.
There's
so little capacity for vinyl right now. I mean, Taylor Swift is selling millions of, you know, she killed it on Record Store Day. That's amazing. Like, who would not welcome that? And yet, it's a problem.
It's this physical format that keeps having these rebirths. And for Denver to have a foothold in that a little bit felt so, maybe we were just like, yeah, over high. I mean, my dreams were just like, we're going to have a Third Man Records of Denver type situation where, but that's really an artist driven investment. You know, Jack White is someone so unique, and this is a very different story of a board and, you know, a corporation and all those things. But I would hope that maybe that plant could still get up to par and someone, if not them, somebody take it over.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, because I think what's happening now is it's going from a, you know, someone with a bullhorn into a company that's looking very carefully at themselves.
Yeah.
You know, Jack White is like this brilliant yet sort of OCD weirdo, top down, heavy hand. So.
Yeah, not saying that he runs his operation perfectly either.
Yeah.
But a music fan.
Totally. Yeah. You know, and I think that's the disconnect at Vinyl Me Please is totally. Excellent product. You know, little unaffordable for most people, but and then behind the scenes, just all this secret disarray.
Well, it remains to be seen. And I agree with you. Maybe the music district will appear somewhere else. We don't know. We're always going to have music.
You don't know. I mean, I think to some extent we'll look back on this and be like, wow, that was a little bit Wild Westy, you know?
It reminds me a little of how much we freaked out when Red Bull came in and was like, Red Bull Sound Select. And everyone was like, oh my God, you're going to play a Red Bull party. Oh my God, your bar's going to serve Red Bull. And then like, it wasn't that big of a deal.
Right. Yeah. How is Red Bull sponsoring shows at Three Kings Tavern?
It was just blasphemous.
But then a lot of local bands made some money and didn't sell out. But then also it was like, who cares?
And then they moved on and were
Like nobody drinks as many Red Bull vodkas now as they did in the mid to late 2000s. So
that's what the kids call the indie sleaze era these days, yeah, John.
Exactly. I look back and I didn't have a Pendleton mustache, but I didn't mind being a dirt bag.
I know it's a little bit of a dirt bag. You know, we were both dirt bags and now we're parents. So
I know, right? Now we're dirtbag parents.
Now we're dirtbag parents. Well, John, last question. You are opening for Guided by Voices at the Marquee this Friday.
Yeah,
May 10th. Again, separate from your work at the Post. This is you as a musician. What? How did this happen? Tell us more about it.
So my house was being worked on last year, and I couldn't play video games every night, which is what I normally do. So I just sat there and made an album on my phone, like a solo instrumental album.
Oh, as one does.
As everyone
AKA
does, yeah.
AKA just you.
And, you know, I mean, I played instruments into it. It wasn't just all synthetic digital. But yeah, and their manager heard it. I've been associated with them very loosely on and off since I was in college. We released a 7-inch with one of their side projects. Their lead singer, Bob Pollard, has done collages for my zine, and I wrote some song titles for him. Long story short, their manager liked it, said, why don't you open for him? And I said, of course, I would love that. This was like only a couple, 3 months ago. So put together a band of all my favorite local musicians and friends and have been rehearsing, but that rehearsal schedule is pretty short because I broke my collarbone about a month
just
ago.
Just a minor thing.
Had surgery and we've had equipment failure. So it's been a road, but yeah, they heard it online. You know, I kind of don't like Facebook, but he heard it on Facebook. So thank God for that.
And now you're going to play a show with them.
Yeah.
That's kind of the dream, to be honest with you. Opening for one of your favorite bands of all time.
My number one favorite band.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I'm from Dayton, Ohio, where they're from. You know, they were sort of crisscrossed with the Breeders at times. Breeders still cover them and stuff. So,
one
you
of
know,
my favorite
90s
bands.
Dayton scene is amazing. And I mean, it's a huge honor. I'm freaked out. I'm really excited.
That's so exciting.
Yeah. It's so weird. It was a dream I never even...
It's weird, but it's 20 years in the making, John. You're like, oh, I've just been like laboring and putting out 7 inches and working with them. And then this is the thing you get to do, which is so cool.
Yeah. Well, it's the 30th anniversary of their album. That's my favorite album of all time. And a lot of people consider one of the best indie rock albums of all time, called B-1000. It came out in 94. And I've been obsessed with them since then. So it's weirdly full circle.
Sounds incredible. Can we play one of your songs? Is there one we could play out for our listeners?
If you want something upbeat, you could play Evasion.
Great. We're going to play Evasion.
That's a surf rock song.
What is your band's name?
We're called Undersail, all one word. And you can find us on Bandcamp. The album's called Feel Clear. And it's free to stream.
Awesome. We'll put a link to it in the show notes. John Wenzel, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. I always love coming on.
That's all for today here on CityCast Denver. If you enjoyed this show, why not take a minute to tell former Vinyl Me Please CEO Cameron Schaefer about us. Rate the show wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe to our morning newsletter and learn more about us at denver.citycast.fm. We'll be back tomorrow morning with more news from around the city. See ya.
Paul's old dirty mouse pad. We just roll that out for special guests. You're welcome, yeah. John.